Hello, I'm Richard Allenson with the latest episode in our series, The Record Producers. Each programme focuses on the work of an individual studio expert. And tonight, we're looking at a man who was employed as a runner in his very first studio job, but within a matter of days, found himself working on a recording session with Duke Ellington. His career is nothing less than phenomenal. His name is Bob Clearmountain. Bob's production credits include Simple Minds, Deacon Blue, The Pretenders, Tina Turner, The Who, and Paul McCartney. But we're going to concentrate on a different strand of his work this evening, and that's his unrivaled skill as a mixer. And if you can, listen in stereo. Even better, put some headphones on, and you'll really appreciate what you're about to hear this evening. Because it's in his role as a mixer that he's built up a roster of work that really does read like a definitive listing of popular music. The Rolling Stones, The Clash, Peter Gabriel, Chic, Tears for Fears, Rufus Wainwright, Bon Jovi, The Corrs, and Sheryl Crow. And that's not even the complete list. His name is on an album or a single somewhere in your collection. Tonight we'll hear from a number of artists he's worked with. Brian Adams, Neil Finn, Phil Manzanera from Roxy Music, and one of Bob's most recent projects, Bare Naked Ladies.
Obviously, Bob's entire career has been working towards getting to work with us. So I think abandoning the comfort of his own studio where he's got everything just the way he likes it. I mean, all of that was just a springboard to coming up to Toronto and working with Bare Naked Ladies. And,
Bruce Springboard.
Yeah, Bruce Springboard.
And yes, of course, Bruce.
One of the things he does incredibly in his mixes is he creates tension that is read as excitement. You know, that's why his mixes are exciting. They're tight as a rubber band and they sound like they're gonna pop, right? And when you give him something, very often he gives it back to you, and all of a sudden he has created just a degree of tension in them that makes them sound contained and constrained and very exciting.
Bruce Springsteen, and there'll be more from Bruce throughout this evening's program, but first I suppose we should determine exactly what a mixer does. As usual, Steve Levine is with me in the studio to try to illustrate what we hear tonight. Steve, if you can, in a nutshell, how does the role of a mixer differ to that of a producer?
Well, it's often said the role of a record producer is similar to that of a movie director. So using the film analogy, a mixer's role is similar to that of a film editor. Whilst a film editor assembles all the various scenes together to convey the story the screenwriter imagines, so a sound mixer will effectively balance all the various instruments and the vocals to get the best out of the song and get that across to the listener. Of course, a mixer shouldn't be confused with a remixer. Remixers are often associated with dance music, and a remixer might work with just a few vocal tracks, a few vocal phrases, and build an entirely new backing track. So a mixer very rarely re-records any new material, and 9 times out of 10 works solely with the sounds already recorded and presented to him or her.
Okay, so that's how you, Steve, as a record producer, sees the job of a mixer. This is how a musician sees that role.
He hears the information on your tape in a way that you cannot, first of all. So what he's listening to is different than what you're listening to. And that's sort of step one of his talent. Step two is a mixer's life is basically one of organization, or the organizing of sound. So there's a drive to create some sort of order, but also beauty. And I always tell Bob when if I listen to Tunnel of Love or some of those records, I think that Bob creates a spiritual place in the mix that is just about him. Because I hear spaces that I did not hear before. You have to go deep down and connect it, I think, once to instinct, but also to a certain level of spirituality and the desire to create something of beauty. And Bob's mixes are hopeful. You know, and the way he creates them and his desire to create them and what he returns to you is always something that's more hopeful than what you presented to him. So tell me who I see. Classic example, the Seeger sessions. I like the rough mixes. The whole thing was ideas. We can throw it around the living room. We made our rough mixes. They sounded great. One afternoon, I went with Bob and sure enough, he handed the stuff back to me in a way that was both incredibly sort of true to the original experience, and yet just enhanced in a way that I think created just a more significant bridge to the audience. And I remember telling him, I said, Paz, this is a great mix. He said, oh, we don't have any mixes here. He says, you know, there's no cymbals over everything. Everything's in everything else, because we recorded everything in one room. But there was a mix there. There was a mix there. And it was quite, it was very significant. So it's, to me, Bob, you know, when I think about both just our friendship, I've been a friend with him for a long time. But I think that people look at mixing and that kind of production as a technical exercise very often. And they lose the part of it that has to do with the human feeling, and I don't believe it's pretentious to say a certain level of spirit that he takes from himself and gives to you in the spaces that he creates. You know, I mean, basically that's what a mixer defines, redefines, enhances, transforms, shapes the space that you've worked in into something slightly different and slightly his and slightly yours. Bob is singular at this. Well, if I could, I surely would. Staying on the rock where Moses stood. If I was on the God drowned it. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't mourn. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't mourn. If I was on the God drowned it. Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep. From Bruce Springsteen's album We Shall Overcome, The Seeger Sessions, his most recent collaboration with Bob Clearmountain.
Bruce is very aware of creating a particular type of mood. He's trying to get a certain feeling across, and these little, very subtle variations, like different types of reverb or different types of delay, or there's just these subtle little things make a big difference to the way a song gets perceived, and he's extremely aware of that. And so it's got to come across exactly the right way. Otherwise, to him, it loses the overall effect. That's what mixing is all about, really. You know, it's all about subtlety, I think.
A testament to the esteem in which Bob is held as a mixer can be seen not only in the extensive list of artists he's worked with, but also how those artists genuinely appreciate and admire his collaborations with other musicians.
I had one summer where all I played was on my car stereo. I had this convertible Camaro, and it was one of the last summers when I think I thought I was young. And and I used to come home late every night to this one specific song. It was Roxy Music's More Than This. There's just something in that the spirit aspect that I'm trying to convey. And it was just a glorious thing to listen to.
First single from Avalon, the last album by Roxy Music, released in 1982. And it's a record Bob Clearmountain remembers with great affection.
The main thing there was the production. The Rhett Davis production with Roxy was amazing. And it was at its peak at that point, I think. And so it gave me a lot of room to do what I do, you know, to be able to add. The arrangements are so clear and there's so much space in there that gave me quite a bit of freedom to enhance. That was a tremendous thing for me. At the time when we were mixing it, I loved it, but I didn't really realize it would be such a big thing. I mean, I've gotten far more comments on that than anything else I've ever done. You know, I've had people just say that children were conceived to that album and things like that, you know.
Roxy's guitarist Phil Manzanera has been working on the long-overdue follow-up album in his own gallery studios. And that's where we asked him whether Avalon was really made with either potential population explosions or American rock stars cruising the freeways in mind.
Not at all. I mean, you know, we're always on a journey with Roxy, and you've got no idea when you start on the journey where you're going or where it's going to end up. And Avalon itself was the product, really, of me having my own studio. The old gallery studios, we're in the new gallery studios now, But the old Gallery Studios was specifically built so that we could all play inside the control room. And the reason I did it was because I was originally building the studio with Kevin Godley and Dol Green from 10cc, and they had a tradition of having huge control rooms. So we had, in effect, the biggest control room in Europe at that time.
Which meant that in Phil's original studio, the band could sit on the same side of the glass as the producer and the engineer and exchange musical ideas between both the band members and the recording crew. And with the help of the later studio equipment and mixing console, immediately transfer those fresh ideas onto what was then tape.
By the time I had the studio in Chertsey, they'd invented a Lindrum, and so we literally fed the instruments into the desk and used the desk as an instrument. But of course, in the back of our minds, we were always going to be taking this stuff to New York to get Bob Clearmountain to mix it. So it was recorded on a very, very simple desk, and we had the ability to all play it together in the control room, and you know, there's a lot of contact and to play, and a lot of sort of jamming and experimenting. Those sounds, which we constructed in Chertsey, then, you know, once they got to New York, were given that sort of Clearmountain, what I call rock edition, which I love because he always made the guitars loud. There's always been lots of guitar parts on Roxy albums. I used to get cheesed off in the early days when people said, well, there's no guitar on this, and of course they couldn't make out what that sound was, and they thought it was synth or something. But right from the days of Eno treating the guitar and stuff, we've developed sort of a mixture of sounds and conventional playing. But on the track Avalon itself, there's about five different guitars. There's one that sounds like a synth, which is a volume pedal guitar. There's more conventional rhythm chacks or whatever. There are a little melody. There's a Firebird, Gibson Firebird, distorted bit on it. There's probably at least five, but I'd have to hear it.
So we're in the studio with Hank Lindemann, famous LA session guitarist. Mm. Thank you for joining us again, Hank. What are we going to do first then? Because there's lots and lots of guitar parts on that one Avalon track.
Well, just at the very top of Avalon, the first thing you hear is a swelled-in guitar. He's playing a chord, which is actually this chord, but he plays the chord and then uses his finger to turn on the volume control of the guitar. So you get this. And he swells that in and out a couple of times. So that's the first guitar part that you hear.
So that's a volume swell.
Yes, and then the next thing that you hear, I believe, is the tremolo guitar. I'm going to play a chord straight without tremolo. Okay, now I'm going to turn on the tremolo pedal. And this sound ends up in the verse of the song, so you'll hear it. It's very easy to recognize. So that's that.
Classic guitar sound.
Yeah, absolutely. Then the next thing he does is kind of a muted picking part. Ends with what's called a double stop, where you play two strings at once and a slide. There's an additional double stop part that's an overdub, but it's very similar. And then finally, he plays his solo. Let's see.
And it's interesting on that sound that in the mix there's also some delay and some reverb added to the sound as well. Each one of these sounds would have been recorded separately, though, as separate parts, because one of the trademarks that Phil often remarks is that he would record multiple tracks of different ideas, and then they'd pick and choose the best parts that he played, but obviously leaving Bob to actually, in the final mix balance, to decide the levels of each thing.
Well, and that becomes part of composition, too, because when you're in the heat of it, it's almost better to just let yourself go and worry later, sort out the good bits.
So now we've heard the different sounds that are actually on the record. Phil has kindly given us the original multitrack of Avalon. You can hear Brian Ferry's vocal very, very quietly in the background. You can hear all the guitars incredibly loud. And I think there's even a little bit of the saxophone as well. But bear in mind the way these guitars are. when they're this loud, it obviously can sound like a mess, but in the original mix of it, it's incredible how they're beautifully balanced. The other interesting thing that you'll notice is that the original drum track is actually what's called a Linn drum, and Phil mentions this, that he'd used a Linn drum for the original backing track, just a basic beat to write the song to. So this doesn't even have the finished drum sounds on it.
So this is the track that they gave to Brian Ferry to go away to think about lyrics to sing over.
That's exactly right.
That was Phil Manzanera's performance on the master tape, and here's how Bob Clearmountain wove all those individual sounds into the final mix.
When the samba takes you out of nowhere, when the background fades out of focus, is the picture changing every moment? And your destination, you don't know where. Avalon.
This is a mark of Bob Clearmountain's genius, is that that album was mixed in 1 week. The session started at 10 o'clock in the morning, and from 10 till 1, or 1:30, was one track mixed. From 2 to 6, the other track was mixed, and every day those tracks were just mixed, boom, 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 boom. And Bob had his studio, little studio, set up with all his tricks and sounds. And so he had all the tools of his trade, all the palettes of sounds all set up so he could work quickly, and he just went straight for the jugular every time. And maybe if we'd mixed it back in Chertsey, it would have been too spread out and arty-farty or whatever, but he really sort of nailed it in terms of tightening up all areas and just the EQs. And this is a man at the top of his game.
Puns could be made about career pinnacles for someone whose surname is Clearmountain, but artistically, Avalon is, as Phil Manzanera just said, the sound of a man who both clearly knows his craft and is enjoying a creative peak. And if we're talking in terms of commercial success, Bob's greatest achievements came in the 1990s, when just two songs he mixed spent a total of 31 weeks at number one. 15 of those weeks came from Wet 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 and Love Is All Around. The other 16 were with Everything I Do It For You. Produced by Mutt Lang, mixed by Bob, and recorded by Brian Adams.
We started mixing the album, and this came a point where we might look at each other and was like, you know what, let's get Bob in to do some mixes for us. Bob knows your sound really well, and I said, yeah, okay. So I called Bob, and I said, well, I can't come for a couple of weeks. And during that 2 weeks, we wrote some more songs and recorded them. We wrote a song called Vanishing. We wrote a song called Hey Honey, I'm Packing You In. And we wrote a song called Everything I Do It For You. What had happened was I received a tape from an old friend of mine who used to work with me at A&M called David Kirschenbaum. And David was masterminding the music of a film and wanted to know if I could make sense out of a 40-minute orchestration and see if I could find a song in there. I played it for Mutt, and we both looked at each other because there was a little fragment of a piano. And he said, that's interesting, play that again. And we built the song around this la-da-da-reading and sat in the back of Battery Studios in Willesden, and within 40 minutes had written this song.
The melody of the song is the main theme of the Robin Hood movie, and that's Caymans. Mutt and Brian wrote the lyric and the bridge. There's actual lyrics in there that come directly out of the film. And they were just really going for the jugular on that. They just pulled out all the stops, all the hit stops. That was specifically designed to be what it turned out to be. It was interesting because I figured out that it recouped the cost of the entire album before we even finished mixing the album, which is really a good thing. The joke is, the lyric really should have been, "Everything I do it for cash."
Everything I do it for you, from Bryan Adams' album Waking Up the Neighbors. This was Brian's first record with Mutt Lange in the production chair, a seat previously occupied by the subject of tonight's program, Bob Clearmountain. Producers and their production styles can be as varied and individual as the musicians they work with. A change of producer can often bring out very different talents in a recording artist, even in someone like Bryan Adams, who already had a very successful track record.
One of the things that I learned working with Mutt was, even though the melody of an instrument's doing one thing, the vocal instrumentation can do another thing. So it's like a counter melody. The piano goes, and then I go, "Look into my eyes, you will see what you mean to me." So like the vocal's almost answering the piano. Whereas I could have sang on top of the piano, but that's where Mutt's genius came in. Don't put it on top of the piano, just put it next to the piano so your vocal has the space. First time we sang the verse back to each other, and we both looked up and smiled and thought, "Oh, this is going to be a good song." But I didn't really think much more than that about it. It needed a middle eight, which was going to take it somewhere. It needed a great sort of instrumentation. That's why that dong, dong, dong section where the guitar comes in, all those changes happened in this short period of time, which we embellished onto that original piano part. Needed all that stuff before it became a song.
But once it was a song, Brian still relied on the ears of Clearmountain to mix it into its final form. They were long-term collaborators as producer and artist, but Bob now found himself coming into work on recordings that Brian had made with someone else, and one might expect a degree of uneasiness between the former and the current producer. Avril McIntosh worked as the assistant to Bob on the track.
The recording of Everything I Do, I remember it was done very, very, very quickly. And it was like the quickest thing that was done on the album. I think it took like maybe a week to record. And then the mixing, it took a week to mix because I just think people had a sense that it was a very special tune. I think Bob was going kind of mad after 7 days because he would normally mix it in a day. So there was all sort of tensions, but it was very interesting seeing the two of them and how they dealt with each other or worked together.
Everything I Do is a lush ballad from the 90s where Bob came in to mix work recorded by Brian with another producer. But if you check out the majority of Brian's recordings in the 80s, tracks such as Run to You, Summer of 69 and Heat of the Night, Bob wears both the producer's and the mixer's hat. Brian knew from day one of his recording career that he was just the right man for the job.
When I first started, it was definitely because I wanted to get a great drum sound. The whole emphasis of my music was based behind a really strong backbeat, and the first thing I needed to do was find a drummer that could pull that off, and then it was just the sound. I mean, to get a sound that sounded like how I wanted to sound. So I really needed to find an engineer that could get the drum sound, to get the great guitar sound, because I mean, I was just 19, 20 years old. I didn't know how to mic anything up. I didn't know anything about technology, how to balance things or mix things. I just knew if it sounded right. From all the records that I'd listened to, every time I saw Clearmountain's name on a record, I always noticed there was something specific about the sound, and generally we had a great drum sound. And I think the first time I sort of recognized it, put it together, was his mix of the Rolling Stones' Miss You. It was the way he balanced it and got everything to sound so incredibly clear.
One of the songs that made a young Bryan Adams want to collaborate with Bob Clearmountain. There's an aspect of the work of the producer that Brian touched on a little earlier regarding Mutt Lange on Everything I Do, which is also one of the roles undertaken by Bob, and that's nurturing the songwriting talent of the artist.
I encouraged Brian to try to delve deeper into writing stuff that he cared about instead of just writing just a boy girl kind of whatever, which he's really good at, and the big romantic power ballads that he was known for. But I also said, you know, try to write things that are important to you. And so the Into the Fire album was a lot of that. I don't know how much of it came from me, but it's my favorite one, actually. It's a much darker album, I think, lyrically. People are saying, well, you're not Springsteen or you're not John Mellencamp or whatever, so you can't do that kind of thing, which is a shame because I thought he did it pretty well.
Recorded by Bob Clearmountain in Brian's house, using the bathroom, the bedroom and the dining room to isolate the instruments, and all finished off with Bob's trademark drum sound, which Brian had always wanted on his records. Now, there's an obvious chemistry here between Brian the musician and Bob the studio technician, which Avril McIntosh sums up.
If there's anything I've learnt from Bob, it's just the way he deals with people, and it's just that he's a really nice guy. And he just makes people feel really comfortable, and you know you're going to get something good when you work with Bob. Brian sent me his anthology, and that's a double album with, you know, like about, I don't know how many tracks, over 25 or whatever years. And there was only one track that Bob hadn't mixed. Now, if that's not saying something, that Bob mixed all those tracks over that length of time. So I think that really says something, that Brian has stuck with one person for that length of time. That really says it all.
If you want to analyze the way Clearmountain mixes records, it would always surprise me what he would do with the sound, because he would always find a place, first of all, between the drums and the voice, where he would put my voice on top of the band. It was never too far that it seemed like it was away from the band, but it was never that close that it seemed like it was in the same room. But if you listen to the record, it works, and that's just his magic. Where he puts the vocal is actually the most crucial.
Well, we're about to find out, I hope, that it's the placing of every element in the recording which is important. We're in Steve Levine's studio at the mixing console. There's a band you've been working with quite a lot recently called 6 Day Riot, and we're going to try quickly to show how a mixer can mix a hit record. What have we got here, Steve? We've got an awful lot of faders in one line, about 68 of them, I think.
Well, as you can see, all the faders are in a straight line,
right,
at what would be called a zero level. And as soon as the track plays, you can hear all the instruments playing back, but of course there's no balance to the track. There's no separation between the drums, the guitars or the vocals. Everything is panned centrally. There's nothing to the extremities left or right. And again, that makes for a mono but very dull mix. So the first thing that you would do when you're presented with this would be maybe have a look at, say the drum track. And let's have a look at the drums on this song. So here's a bit of just the drums and percussion. I'm just adding now a little bit of EQ, and I'm going to start to pan them around. I'll add the bass, which on this song is an acoustic bass, a stand-up bass, or double bass. So you can hear, by separating out and balancing just slightly the snare drum, the bass, how that's beginning to be a bit clearer. Maybe bring the guitars in now. And you can hear how some of the guitars are on the left, some are on the right. There's also a mandolin on this track. And you can hear how half of the mandolin is on one side and half is on the other side. And this is with no reverb, this is just the instruments dry. The next crucial stage is to have a look at the vocals, because obviously getting a backing track balance is only half of the job. So let's solo some of the vocals. There's quite a lot of backing vocals as well as a lead vocal on this. And now we're at the instrumental section of this song, so in fact I could bring in maybe the organ. Here we are. Now here's the vocals coming back in. Now, vocals really often benefit from reverb, so let me add some reverb. Hear how the reverb separates the backing vocals from the lead vocal. It's really crucial in mixing to get this balance between them. And many artists don't like to hear their vocals like this isolated.
It looks like a very dark art, because it's easy to get it wrong, but when it's right, it just feels proper.
Well, let's hear how this sounds closely to my full mix. So there's the final mix balance. You know, you can hear the vocals, guitars all very clearly, and that's what one would do to mix as a final record.
And you can treat every one of the... How many channels have you got running here?
Well, there's 64 recorded instruments on here, bearing in mind right. Some of those are recorded in stereo, so they take two tracks.
And how long would a whole mix of one track like that take, on average?
Well, it's a relatively straightforward song, so on something like this, about a day's worth of time, although during that day I would often take frequent breaks, just to keep fresh. It's really, really important.
It's fascinating watching you work. Thanks, Steve. So, in other words, while a mixer has to be not only technically adept to understand the mechanics of studio equipment, the skill and the ability to balance out the sounds is equally, if not more, important. Basically, it all boils down to a really decent pair of ears. So is the work of a mixer a technical, or is it an artistic skill, or is it a bit of both? Neil Finn's entrusted his work to Bob Clearmountain over the last two decades.
You assume when you walk into a room with somebody like Bob that the technical side is just incredibly together, and it always is. You don't have to think about it, really. So in that regard, I think of it as an artistic process at a point where you really look for, you're needing a reward for all the work and the slaving and the struggle of writing, arranging, rehearsing, recording. Generally speaking, we walk in and it's the big reward is you get Bob puts another 10-20% on it and you haven't had to do a thing. It's always a huge delight to walk into the mix and hear the track sounding better than you've ever heard it, and kind of transformed, it has to be said. There's a kind of an element of, oh my God, somebody's come in and actually put the magic knob on it, you know, and vocally particularly, I think Bob has a way of getting the vocal to sit in a very sweet, airy place, but have all the power that you want. It's always a delight.
Neil Finn, pretty much reiterating what Brian Adams said a little earlier about vocal placement. Whilst Bob had a history as a producer with Brian, it was Mitchell Froom, Chad Blake and Youth who produced Neil's recordings. But with Bob as mixer across not only a number of Crowded House recordings, but also Neil's solo work and his collaborations with his brother Tim. So how do the roles of producer and mixer balance out in a record?
Every album is a completely distinct story to the last. Youth was a very different type of producer to Mitchell, in many ways left a lot more things on tape to be decided by Bob, as it turned out, and he was hugely relieved to have somebody like Bob come in and be able to sort it out. To be honest, Mitchell's much more economical producer, usually works towards a point where the arrangement's on tape and fairly defined, you know, not to say Bob wouldn't add quite a lot in the mix, but I think with Together Alone particularly, he sorted out vast reams of material at certain points and managed to find a space for most of it too, which is great. You know, whether or not it was a skillful arrangement is another story, but he managed to find space for the most obscure overdubs, you know, tongue and log drums at the end of the song Private Universe. Bob managed to work him in and it sounded great.
Private Universe, from the Crowded House album Together Alone. Neil's most recent collaboration with Bob came on the album Everyone Is Here, recorded by Neil and Tim as the Finn Brothers.
The song that Bob first mixed on the last record, in fact the reason really it all went in Bob's camp, was a song called Won't Give In, and we'd recorded a whole version of it, mixed and mastered a whole version, and it wasn't a standout track on the record. It was kind of holding its head up because it had a certain honesty to it, I suppose, in the end. But we rediscovered another arrangement for it, and it suddenly started to stick its head up. And we gave it to Bob as a kind of to see how he would work with it. We were so knocked out by the result. He just put so much extra into it. It was one of those joyous moments in the studio where you go in and you have no idea what's about to happen. And at the end of it, we're all pretty speechless, really. And that was then, it seemed incredibly obvious that Bob should go ahead and mix the whole record at that point. So, yeah, that was a triumph, I think, on Bob's part. It turned out to be the song on the record that did the best at radio as well. So, yeah, it was a great good luck story. It means that I won't give in. Won't give in. Won't give in. Cause everyone I love is here. Playing once. Disappear. The point where you're going to take it to radio, you're up against everything that's out there, so any bit of advantage you can find, and Bob is good at finding advantage in songs or little bits of colour that you didn't realise you had, or, you know, a quirk in the arrangement that he'll suddenly feature or whatever, and it just make it sound like it's a more complete record.
And in terms of a complete record, we need look no further than Bob's handiwork on Neil Finn's only top 10 single so far, this one by Crowded House. Walking round the room singing stormy weather. Weather With You, from the Crowded House album Woodface, which contains some of Phil Manzanera's favourite Bob Clearmountain mixes.
I remember being in the studio in LA, by coincidence, when they were mixing that album. There's a combination of them doing recording in their house in Melbourne, and then taking stuff over to Clearmountain. And Clearmountain really sorting it out and giving it a proper sort of professional, fantastic balance and spatial awareness, I think, in the mix. You know, that's a great album. I also adore Springsteen stuff that Bob's done. And I mean, there's one track that sounds like it could be a Roxy track from the Avalon period. I had no idea that Springsteen had ever listened to any Roxy stuff anyway, but obviously maybe because of the Bob Clearmountain connection. But the sound on that was so similar, and his delivery was just so wonderful. Every time I hear it, I think, could he have heard Roxy and been impressed? No, couldn't possibly be, no. I was bruised and battered, I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. I saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh, brother, are you gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia? Streets of Philadelphia by Bruce Springsteen, who mentioned earlier that he loved Roxy Music's hit More Than This from 1982. Was that the sonic inspiration for Bruce's song 12 years later? Who knows? But Bob Clearmountain's first work with Bruce certainly predates that Roxy track.
The first time we worked with Bob was on the River album, and he was just a very young kid. And we came in and we cut a song called Roulette, which didn't end up on the River out of some dumb decision-making process of my own. He did a very quick mix of it that day. I guess my best way to describe what Bob does is he increases the impact of whatever information you provide him. You know, and he does this in a way that is so unique and solely individual that his fingerprints end up a good deal over what you've done. And these are the days before automated mixes. So the mixer sat at the end of the session or whenever you decided to mix and basically manually mixed the song. Bob was so quick even at that time, and I was so slow that literally he was just too fast for me at that time. And he was so instinctive, and he was daring. He would just reach over the board and crank that EQ if he wanted to. And he would throw the highs on to a place where you think that they wouldn't be able to stay, and then he'd balance it out on the bottom. So you had these very, I look back on them as very swashbuckling mixes, you know, and that he was doing, he was completely sort of this, somewhat temperamental. He was young, he was still young. He did it in about three or four mixes, it was done. After that, it was sort of, well, what exactly are we doing here? You know, I often, in those days, particularly used to like to sit back and go, well, I don't know. And time would pass, hours, days on occasion. And for Bob, whose own idea about what he was doing was, even at that particular time, very, very specific. And so consequently, on the river, he mixed the one song, Hungry Heart, which of course was our one hit. All right. And if you listen to it, you know why. He turned it into a classic sort of pop record.
First hit for Bruce and Bob together, Hungry Heart, from the river. Theirs is an association and a friendship that's lasted over 25 years. But Bob has also worked with Bruce's wife, the singer Patti Scialfa, and it's not because she's Mrs. Springsteen. Their relationship goes back even further.
I met Bob in the mid-70s. I was living in New York. I just graduated from NYU. I remember I had to get a straight job because my voice was very hoarse. So I went and I got a job as a receptionist at Media Sound at the time. They were a really well-known studio for churning out disco music. And Bob had come in. He only worked in the... If you wanted to learn how to be an engineer, they used to ask everybody to work in the mailroom at Media Sound. And so some people would be in the mailroom for like a year or so, turn into fantastic engineers. But I think Bob was there in the mailroom for like the shortest amount of like 7 days before they moved him into the studio.
Though my party dress is torn, I still walk and talk in bright and cold. I've got no one on my heart. Well, I am just a rumbled dog.
The title track from Patti Scialfa's 1993 album, Rumble Doll. And whilst a lot of Bob's work with Patti's husband has been mixed in studios such as the Power Station in New York, Patti's music was mixed in more homely surroundings.
My first record, Rumble Doll, I mixed at his house. He's got a great setup. I just think at a certain point in your life, it's really wonderful when you can get your work figured out where it's not taking a majority of the time away from your personal life, where you can have a personal life and have it integrated into your music or your art or whatever. I think that's the hardest thing to do, especially when you're very dedicated to your work and very good at your work. I think then the hard thing to do is to find a way of, well, gee, I want a real life too, and I want a home life, and I want a life, so how do I make all this work and spend this much time work, you know, in the studio? So he is the best of it, both worlds, having that place in his house. But now they have the ISDN line. What it does, it enables you to, you have the line set up into your house like a computer, they bring it in. We have these really nice speakers that are compatible with Bob's setup and that he likes. And then he dials you at home and you dial up the mix and you talk and they mix the record and you're hearing it as exactly as you would hear it in the studio.
There's a homely aspect to a lot of Bob's work. But for one of Bob's most recent projects, he forfeited his home comforts and flew north of the 49th parallel to Toronto to work with the Bare Naked Ladies on their new self-produced album, Bare Naked Ladies Are Me. They took a break from mixing to talk about why they wanted to work with Bob. Here's guitarist Ed Robertson.
One of the things that most excited me about working with Bob was that he had done all those amazing Crowded House records. Seeing how he could just take a really vibey, personal singer-songwriter type of song and put so much atmosphere into the mix, that got us very excited about working with him.
Here's Bare Naked Ladies drummer Tyler Stewart.
We have a track called The Sound of Your Voice that Kevin wrote that originally he sang on the bed track, and Steve Page, our lead singer, ended up singing the song. What we did was kind of surround that very powerful lead vocal with layers upon layers of tasty backing vocals. Bob Clear Mountain in the mix managed to make the track absolutely exciting with his vocal mix as well. That's a good example of the way he can take tons and tons of different vocal tracks.
About 40 tracks
of vocals.
Yeah. And some of the tracks were three guys singing into one mic.
Yeah, and make it sound
very huge.
Huge, and also doesn't sound overproduced. It sounds kind of natural.
So, Steve, not many artists let anybody anywhere near their beloved master recordings, but the Bare Naked Ladies have given us the backing vocals from their multi-track masters. Is that right?
Yeah, they've very kindly given us a breakdown of the actual backing vocals that Bob had to work with. So these are the multi-tracked vocal parts. They don't have any reverb or any extra effects on them, so they're just as clean as the moment they recorded them. So we can hear how complicated the actual parts are.
Because there were 40 voices in there.
Exactly, there's about 40 voices, so that's multi-tracked on top of each other, and also, as they mentioned, several singers around one microphone to create that really thick sound. So normally it's quite difficult to balance the vocals of that magnitude in a track, and you can hear firstly the isolated vocals and how great they actually sound. Again, no reverb on them, just exactly as they sang them, and then how Bob has managed to blend them into the master mix. So let's listen to the first part. So here's the chorus part, and you'll hear very clearly the layering there. That's just an ooh sound. Listen out now for the additional parts as they come in, and you'll hear the words are also multi-tracked.
For the sound of your voice, wake it up, sound.
And those form part of the bridge section just before the chorus comes in, and now here's the big main chorus section that's actually on the record.
Sound to the sound.
So if you focus your mind on what you've just heard, and now listen out for those exact pieces, those exact vocal parts in the final mix that Bob did, and you'll get a sense of what the mixer does.
This ain't goes, there will be other dancers.
Don't give up.
This little song is about second chances.
Bare Naked Ladies, the latest in a long line of artists who have worked with Bob Clearmountain. A final word from Tyler Stewart.
His drum sounds are also incredible. Not only does he know how to mix recorded drums, he comes armed with a battery of Bob Clearmountain drum samples. That's a great thing, is he comes to the job totally equipped. So let's say, for instance, your hi-hat wasn't mic'd properly. He has a sample in his collection that could easily replace that hi-hat sound. So you'll have the drum performance, but you'll have a exquisitely recorded Bob Clearmountain hi-hat sample to fill in. And that's just an example of the kind of things he comes to the table with.
Now, Steve, Brian Adams mentioned earlier about Bob's amazing drum sound. Tyler, the drummer with the Bare Naked Ladies, mentioned his drum sounds as well. How does he make drums sound better?
Well, I think it's down to experience. I mean, Bob has access to some incredible recording studios all around the world. And I think that when you've got the experience of knowing how to mic a drum kit up, that's the difference. It's not just a simple case of putting a drum kit in a room and placing some mics in front of it. You need the years of experience. And then, of course, when you get the track, particularly if it's a set of drums that he hasn't recorded himself, maybe another engineer's recorded them, he has the ability to manipulate those sounds either by replacing them with some of his own samples or indeed his careful mixing tricks.
A demonstration, please.
Well, the Bare Naked Ladies have given us their rough mix version of the track Wind It Up. Now, this is the band doing the mix after they've recorded the parts. And it's very often when you finish a session, you will do a rough mix, just pushing the faders up, getting a rough idea. Listen to the difference between the band's mix and the way that Bob has mixed it. There's two things that I think are very noticeable on this. First of all, of course, the classic Clear Mountain drum sound. The drums are the same parts, but he's added his magic sound to it. But of course, listen to how great the guitars sound. The guitars have taken on a whole new life. They're the same parts, exactly the same parts that the band played. But listen to the difference in the sound. So we'll start by playing a little bit of the band's rough mix of the track. now we'll play Bob's version of the track.
Same instrumentalists, same instruments, just a new mix.
A new mix with very careful EQ, very careful reverbs. It's all down to that special taste that Bob has and the ability to balance the instruments.
A Bob Clearmountain mix.
A classic Bob Clearmountain mix.
So how did he make the drums sound better?
Well, if you listen to that track, you can hear that although the parts are exactly the same, the drum sounds themselves are slightly different. And what Bob has is his own collection of classic Clear Mountain drum sounds. Now, he's recorded these in studios all around the world. And the way you do this is you get the studio set up, you get the drummer to do a selection of hits, snare drums, bass drums, tom-toms, and you record those with and without room ambience. And then when you get a drum track that maybe you're not so happy with the drum sound, you can replace the individual sounds. Now, this takes a lot of care and attention, but when you're skilled, like somebody like Bob is, you can do it. So I've set a little example up just to show you how that works. So I'll start with a drum loop where I'm quite happy with the groove of the drum loop. No problems with that, but the sound isn't great. Now have a listen to some of Bob's classic snare drum sounds. The first one is a dry sound, the second one has got the room ambience. And Bob will often do a selection of these sounds so that you can choose, because not every track needs the same amount of room sound on it. So listen to the quiet snare drum with no reverb, and now the loud snare drum.
And it's the same drum?
It's the same drum, just a different hit of the drum.
Right.
Now hear those drums, those snare drum samples, added to my loop. And immediately you can hear how much more impact there is on the actual loop itself.
So he's just added reverb and a bit of echo maybe and placed different microphones in different places.
Exactly. The next thing is the bass drum, or the kick drum as the Americans or Canadians say. So the kick drum is also the same way, recorded with room ambience. Again, you can hear the room sound on it. Now I'm going to add that to my loop as well. So just a refresh, here's the loop originally. And now here's the loop with the new bass drum or kick drum sound and the new snare drum. And you can hear how much more impact it has. So it's the same feel, but a much better drum sound. And that's how he does it. And if ever there was an iconic drum sound, then it probably has to be this.
Track from one of the biggest selling records of the 1980s. Bruce's manager and executive producer John Landau says they'd worked on that album for close to 2 years and had given songs from it to several mixers to get some comparisons in sound. If you remember, Cyndi Lauper had just broken big, and Bruce and John liked the sonic qualities the production team got on her record She's So Unusual. There were also a couple of other hot mixers at the time, but when they heard what Bob had done, Bruce knew it was right.
Bob's mix came back and it was just so individual. There were a variety of other mixes, many of which were good, but just when you put his on, there was just something to it that has been inexplicable. Really, to this day, I've mixed many, many, many records with him.
Born in the USA, for the most part, is a live album recorded in the studio. With a few overdubs here and there, they'd add a guitar here and there or a keyboard. Bruce would maybe change a lyric or two, but he would sing live and play, everything was live. because of that, it was probably about the easiest album I've ever mixed. I just get a balance, and they were so used to playing with each other, they'd never step on each other like a lot of studio guys tend to do, where you have to weed through and pull stuff out here and there to make room. It was just a balance.
Born in the USA. Probably about the easiest album he'd ever mixed. It was just a balance. It's a massive sound, but with every part crystal clear in the mix. A trademark of the Clear Mountain touch, and a skill summed up by Bruce Springsteen and Phil Manzanera.
He'd get to the essence of the thing. And it's great to have that perspective on something at the very last stage, you know, a fresh set of ears and somebody who's sonically adept at putting it all together, all the frequencies together properly.
Bob's like, you know, he's like a great songwriter or something. He does this particular thing. And I suppose somebody who's might be able to explain to you technically what some of what he's doing is, but as the old story was, if it was that simple, everybody'd be doing it.
Yeah. And one final comment from Neil Finn on the music that Bob has mixed for others that he particularly enjoys.
The records that I rediscovered recently through having young kids and wanting to find something to dance to, you know, those early records he did with Chic and with Sister Sledge and that are just landmarks, I think. They're incredibly clear, solid, fat recordings with amazing amount of vibe. I just don't think the dance floor has ever sounded any better than that.
Yes, Bob Clearmountain's recorded, produced or mixed just about everything over his career. Hard rock, lush ballads, sophisticated pop and even disco. And that's where we'll go on the next program in this series of The Record Producers with a man who changed the course of dance music forever, producer Nile Rodgers. I'm Richard Allinson. The Record Producers was devised by Steve Levine, written by Neil Miners, with digital enhancement by Darren Sell and Hank Lindemann, and is produced for BBC Radio 2 by Magnum Opus Broadcasting.